Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this episode number 127 of the Free Cities Podcast. This episode, as always, is brought to you by our fabulous sponsors, Veritas Village, a phenomenal project in Panama building off-grid, energy self-sufficient luxury homes for freedom lovers. And I think in their time-honored tradition of attracting people to a physical location and then creating ground-up free communities, Veritas Village is doing just this. They're creating places where freedom lovers can collect together and build beautiful futures with long-term ideas. You know where to go? www.ecovillages.life/podcast. Don't forget to put the /podcast on the end, or just jump into the show notes for that same link and mention us when you speak to them. Thank you very much indeed. This episode is also brought to you by Trey Franzoy, who brought us out to the USA to meet so many interesting people at the leadership program of the Rockies in Colorado. Today's guest is one such person, so many thanks again for your generosity, Trey. Today, I'm speaking with author and educator Anders Ingemarsson. Now, Anders is a former Swede turned American citizen, and on today's episode, he shares his journey of embracing individualism through the teachings of the wonderful Ayn Rand. In this episode, he reflects on his upbringing in Sweden, the allure of collectivism, and the contrast with American ideals of freedom and personal responsibility. The discussion delves into the philosophical underpinnings of individualism versus collectivism, exploring how cultural indoctrination shapes perceptions of rights and responsibilities. Anders articulates the challenges faced in promoting a philosophy that values the individual over the collective, especially in environments steeped in welfare state ideology. That was obviously my AI assistant doing that. I don't speak like that in real life, do I? However, what about her communist alter ego? How would she sum up this conversation in one sentence? Let's get the view from the other side, as always. In quotes, a misguided ex-Swede, seduced by bourgeois propaganda, abandons the solidarity of the collective for Ayn Rand's cult of selfishness, peddling capitalist illusions of freedom while dismissing the dignity of shared responsibility under socialism. There you go, guys. My God, talk about a buzzkill. Communists are such party poopers, aren't they? Anyway, now for the people who definitely aren't party poopers. That's right, it's the strategic Bitcoin reserve donators, the Nosta warriors. Thank you this week for your wonderful donations. Aaron, Justin Bianchi, or is it Bianchi? You could always reply, because I say your name quite a lot. Christopher Albanese and user 842. Let's see what conversations came with those comments. Aaron says, you know it's a good conversation when the hosts have to suggest wrapping it up four times, only to keep rolling into further fascinating subjects. This starts at around 25 and a half minutes remaining. Long form for the win, Timothy. Thank you, Aaron. Yeah, that was referring to my conversation with Mark Edge last week, which was a good one. And yes, we did keep trying to end the conversation, but, you know, new things kept coming up. And I agree, long form's the way. Justin Bianchi says, great one. Also about the Mark Edge interview. Oh, lots of people like the Mark Edge interview. Christopher Albanese said, unfortunately, for all of us who love free cities, I am not a VP at BlackRock. So for now, you'll be quoting my contributions in the number of Satoshis rather than Bitcoins. If you don't understand that, Christopher Albanese made a very generous donation to the SBR last week, and when I googled his name, there's a VP at BlackRock with the same name. Well, Christopher, and I'm going to borrow a sort of meme from Monty Python's Life of Brian here. That's exactly the kind of thing a VP from BlackRock would say. So let's leave that one open anyway. It's nice to have you here. And thank you for the wonderful donation too. Final user 842 on Fountain just says cheers. That's also for the Mark Edge interview. So if you didn't get a chance to listen to that one, Mark's a bit of an OG from the Free Cities space, and he was a libertarian talk show host for a very long time. I'm going to say 10 years, might even be longer. But that's one not to miss. Right, time for the conversation of this week. Enjoy your alone time, people, with this one. It's a good one. Find a quiet space and, as always, sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Anders Ingemarsson. Now, firstly, I have to ask you this because you're the first European I've actually met here, or former European. Are you an American citizen?
I am an American citizen, American by choice, yes.
Well, it might be interesting then to just hear the story behind that, if you don't mind.
Yes, sure. Born and raised in Sweden. Got interested in Ayn Rand in the early 90s, and she actually got my eyes open for the United States and its founding principles and such, and things that we never learned in history class in back in Sweden. And I came over here for a couple of conferences, found that I liked it. I worked for a company at the time that I managed to get transferred over here, got my green card, and it was off to the races and never looked back.
And did you marry an American lady by any chance?
I did not. I met and married my wife in Switzerland. She's German, and we got married in LA.
Right, so you both emigrated.
We both did, and she was a brave woman. We had dated for 6 months when it was time to move, and she came with me.
Right, well, that's interesting. But that's not a story I think I've heard much, especially not the Ayn Rand angle. I like that. You literally, what did you read, Atlas Shrugged?
I read Atlas Shrugged, and from there, basically everything else, fiction and nonfiction, yeah. I think I had, I had a lot of the pieces of the puzzle, but they never fit into any in the traditional political spectrum, if you like, from right to left. And you know, I was flirting with socialism for a while. I was over on the other end of the spectrum, and somehow something happened, and I thought I had figured it out, and then everything didn't make sense again. And then I read Atlas Shrugged, and especially her nonfiction pieces, and all those pieces came together, and I realized that, you know, what I had thought were the polar opposites of left and right were actually two aspects of the same thing, of collectivism in different varieties and statism.
How do you view your former home country then, of Sweden currently? It's quite, I would say, in Europe it's often idolized, but I think from over here people would think of it as quite a collectivist place.
Well, actually not. It depends on who you talk to here. So on the American political left, it is idolized, just like it probably is in parts of Europe. And it's the welfare statism, you know, they think that everything is free, healthcare and education and so on and so forth. But as we know, nothing is free. It always comes with strings. And if Americans knew what tax bracket they would be in back in Sweden, you know, they would not idealize it as much as they do. So, and then people on the right here, they have recently, at least, they have focused in on the immigration angle. And, you know, they see that Sweden, as many other European countries, have had big challenges with immigration over the last decade or so. And then they have in this view that Sweden, yeah, it's this homogenous Scandinavian country with all these blonde girls and tall white men. And, you know, of course things work, but not realizing that you know, Sweden has had wave after wave of immigration for the past 100 years, and it hasn't. It's only recently that it has created a problem. But for the longest time, Sweden was, even before it became a really deeply ingrained welfare state, it was a magnet for workers from all over Europe coming, because we came out of the Second World War along with Switzerland as the two unscathed countries, and that gave us a great advantage over the first couple of decades.
Well, compare and contrast the US, your life. I mean, how long were you in Sweden for before you left?
About 30 years.
Right.
So I spent a couple of years in Denmark, a couple of years in Switzerland before moving here.
So you've obviously done a lot of time here as well. Compare and contrast for me then the big differences between, because I think Sweden's quite indicative of Europe, of what it's like to live in Europe.
Right.
You know, and having spoken to a lot of Americans, I think we often don't really understand what's going on in each other's countries. There are certain things about the American experience which has taken me a while to just get a hold of, and now I'm sort of starting to see those things. I find the whole place is opening up a little bit more, and it makes a lot more sense to me, you know, because as a youngster for sure, and certainly growing up, American ideals were often vilified within Europe, especially gun culture, especially, you know, brash, freedom loving.
Absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
And which is a strange thought if you care about freedom, which I assumed we all did. But I think what I'm sort of realizing over the last few years is that we're not a hugely freedom loving place, Europe, currently. And so what are your kind of experience? Give me your experience of the difference between the two.
So starting with Sweden and Europe in general, I think it's the proverbial frog in the boiling water, right? So generation upon generation have been steeped into this belief that the welfare state is the savior and the necessity. And they're actually really proud of the welfare state, the safety net, the government safety net that is providing everything. And in my opinion, when you bring up these other ideas that are at the founding of the United States of America, with individualism, individual rights, you know, the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, people can't even grasp what you're talking about, because the education system, and from grandparent to parent to child, you kind of get used to a certain way of thinking. I mean, you could say that they're indoctrinated, but that may be a little bit overstating it. I think it's just something that happens. I see it with my friends, my relatives, and actually after I started to embrace these ideas, I had to decide to pick my battles. You know, in the beginning, wow, this is great. And as soon as my friends and relatives read these books, you know, we will all become capitalists and individualists and things like that. No, it didn't happen. And pretty soon I said, you know, I need to focus my energy on other things, not to get too frustrated. But then contrasting that with the United States, I mean, you have a lot of the European mindset here too. And unfortunately, we're moving in the wrong direction. So we're getting, the American welfare state is vast. It's huge. And Europeans, you know, they think it's all private, right? Yeah, we have a different healthcare system, and many aspects of the healthcare system sucks here. But it's so heavily regulated. It's so heavily taxed. It's so heavily forced upon you by the government. So In practice, I mean, we're not a whole lot better off, unfortunately. But still, there is in the American people a sense of life. They may not be able to articulate it always, and unfortunately, they don't have a solid philosophical foundation for it. I mean, that foundation going back to the expression that was taken in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and obviously history is not taught as it used to be here. That's another problem. But still, there is a sense of life that prevails in large parts of the American population, it's like, don't tread on me, right? And we've seen that in the most recent election, for instance, the reaction to the extreme left. And with Trump's win, and whether you agree with him or not, doesn't really matter. But as a phenomenon, you can see that as an expression of the American sense of life that, you know, you went too far, and now they go there. Now, the concerning or almost tragic side of it is that the people who are swinging, they don't really have that solid philosophical foundation to guide them. And that's where, you know, where I come in, so to speak, where I try to make the case for the fact that, hey, guys, whether you are conservative or Democrat or voting for either or the other, you're basically over here fighting in a territory of which version of statism should prevail in this country. There is not really a fundamental discussion about respecting individual rights in healthcare, meaning that you have the choice to choose it, and respecting it of healthcare, health insurance companies having the right to offer whatever products they think the market needs, right? Our current president has said that Medicare and Social Security are off the table. Those biggest welfare statist programs in this country, and, you know, set aside the practical concern that we have to solve it because it's massively underfunded, fundamentally, it is a violation of people's individual rights. And that's where the American people, they haven't caught up yet with that. So, you know, my mission or my interest is in trying to compare and contrast and give people the other option, which says that this country was founded on individualism. And individual rights is the core moral principle that we need to respect, right? And the only moral socioeconomic system that comes out of that is capitalism. Because capitalism is the only system that respects and protects those rights consistently.
Before we go into individualism and capitalism, which I'd love to, I just want to pick up on something you just said earlier, which was that when you first came to the US and started realizing a few things, you assumed that when you passed on those ideas to people back home, they would embrace them as you did. And that's a common idea in this movement, that it's a battle of ideas. And you and I both probably think about those ideas and have analyzed many other ideas and gone, this one makes the most sense. So why is it that that's not necessarily the case with everyone? Why is it that some people will still, whilst entertaining all ideas, might still, I mean, maybe they didn't entertain all the ideas, I don't know. But why do you think you weren't so well received?
Well, if I knew the answer, it's a question that has, you know, that I don't know that it has really been answered, but I think part of the reason is that most people are not philosophically inclined. And I think one aspect of it is that I always have had a hard time living with contradictions. And I don't think a lot of people are too bothered by it, actually. So going back to my time and, you know, my flirting with the left and the right and things didn't make sense, I never gave up, really. I mean, a lot of people threw up their hands and say, you know what, it is what it is. You can't really know things. And I never gave up. And I think I've seen that in other people in my situation, that they didn't give up. They were not content living with those contradictions, and eventually they came across something that made sense. In my case, it was by Ayn Rand, and things started to make sense. And to this day, you know, yeah, I mean, there are still some contradictions, but they're not of a philosophical nature as much as practical areas. And then if that practical area is important to me, you know, I may pursue that contradiction and figure it out sooner. If it's not that important and I notice that, you know, that doesn't really make sense, that's, however, not that important, I make a mental note of it. And then maybe 6 months, years later, something comes across me and say, oh, that's why that didn't make sense. Okay, you know. So
it's a question of perseverance then.
That's probably part of it, yeah, absolutely. But yeah.
Interestingly, Colorado, where we are now, actually has a place in Atlas Shrugged. Would you care to speak to that? Because I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, so without offering any plot spoilers.
I don't think you need to worry about that
okay,
too much.
All right, okay, yeah. So Colorado is the last bastion of freedom in Atlas Shrugged as a state, while the rest of the country is going collectivist. In the end of the book, or towards the end of the book, Colorado is falling as well. But there is this one place in Colorado called that where the creators, the people of the mind, the ones who are holding up society, holding up Atlas, the Atlas is holding up the world, where they retreat to and kind of withdrawing their sanction from society, and that's why everything is crumbling. And the idea is that that's the only way for the world to realize that they depend on these people that they have been mooching and looting from for ages. And they, one of the financiers in Atlas, he finds this valley in Colorado, and they put a shield over it so that nobody can find it, and that's where they hide out and create their little ideal society. And Ayn Rand got that idea during, I think it was her first or second cross-country trip. And she and her husband, they passed through Colorado, and they came to Ouray, which is a little town, mountain town in southwestern Colorado. And that's where she got the idea and what she modeled her gulch after.
Was there any other significance to it, or just that it's a nice place and it's quite remote?
You know, I don't know if it was any, but anyhow, so my wife and I, when we crossed the country moving from LA to Philadelphia back in 1995, that was the first time we came through Ouray of Colorado. Unfortunately, they didn't have the dollar sign over, but the Star of Bethlehem, so you know that is what it is, but so that someday we'll have the dollar sign over the town.
You did a little pilgrimage on purpose,
it was kind of on. We kind of crisscrossed the country and made a road trip of it, and we stopped by there. And we have gone back regularly since we moved to Colorado. We love that part of the state. I mean, she did pick a beautiful part of the state for her valley.
She did. It's the first time I've ever been here. Interestingly, though, politically, I've heard Colorado is not necessarily Ayn Randian. Is that correct?
No, it's been interesting since we got here in the end of the 90s. It was what we call purple, if you like. We had a conservative governor. I think one or two of the houses were both conservative for a while, and it was kind of flipping back and forth. But for the last, 15, 20 years, I think it's been pretty solidly blue and drifting in that direction.
Okay, segue into individualism and capitalism. Mm-hmm. You've written a book all about it, actually. You gave me a brief synopsis earlier, but I'd quite like you to explain it now. Or maybe I'll tell you what I think, because you already alluded to it earlier. You're concerned about understanding that left and right is the wrong way to address
Political
life, right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
And instead, we should look at it on a spectrum of morality. Is that correct?
Yeah, morally good to bad.
Okay. So why don't you lay out what your morality is? And then I'd like to know how you've deduced that morality, which is often a contentious issue. I mean, some people believe morality is it just is. I don't know.
Yeah. So the morality that we're talking about here, I have to credit Ayn Rand for a lot of these ideas, right? And I, in my book, I just tried to put it in I shouldn't say more easily accessible way, but I wanted to write a book that was short and that people who have never heard of these ideas before could get something out of. So when I talk about the morally right to wrong spectrum, it's the two terms that are fundamental to this are individualism versus collectivism. And collectivism or groupism, you can call it, is the idea, the philosophy that says that your rights should be subordinated the rights of a group of some kind or a collective. And that may be the race, the class, the gender, the age group, whatever the group of your choice is, has a right that trumps your individual rights. Now, that thinking is the source of everything bad in history, because that leads politically to what we call statism. And statism exists on a spectrum from less bad, which would be our current welfare state, where we justify violating individual rights by claiming that it's good for society or some of those other groups that I mentioned. And based on that, when people buy into it, then, you know, then you agree to that, yeah, I have to be taxed so that we can pay for the less unfortunate, pay for the old, pay for schools, for kids, and there is really no end to it. And as soon as you accept statism in some form or another as a political philosophy, or if you like, historically, we tend to drift towards more and more statism, because when you accept the idea, the moral idea, that the group takes precedence over the individual, there's really no end to it, right? And we keep drifting towards the evil end of the spectrum. And as we've seen historically, when we get there, things get really bad. And so the evil end of the spectrum would be your fascist dictatorships, your communist dictatorships. But what's important to know is that fascism and communism on this moral spectrum, they're not opposites. They're on the same end of the spectrum. And then between the welfare statism and the extremist, you have those authoritarians, you have, for instance, theocracies, oligarchies, and things like that. So statism exists on a continuum, on a spectrum, right? And under the welfare statist subgroup, if you like, you can place our two political parties here in the US today, and probably the same with the UK and most European countries. You have the leftists, as I like to call them, mostly represented by the Democratic Party, but you have social democrats, you have democratic socialists, and all these variations. And they kind of play in the same sandbox there in the bad but not evil part of the spectrum. And the same with conservatives. Now, conservatives occasionally are a little bit better. They at least pay lip service to free market ideas, which are more respectful of individual rights. But they're not really that good at defending it. And in the end, they're very challenged by advocating for reducing that welfare state, because deep down inside, a lot of them agree with this collectivist notion that certain groups have rights that trump the rights of individuals. Conservatives often have different groups than the left have, and that's where the group warfare starts, right? So is it my group that has the rights or your group that has the rights? So on the political right today, you know, you have people, religious freedom is a big thing, which is good, right? But there are also people who think that we should have more religion on the conservative side, and that should play a larger role in politics, because, and then of course here in the US it's the Judeo-Christian one, that's the group that should take precedence over Muslims or Jews or whomever the other ones are. And on the left, and of course, we have had the last decade or so with the woke, and every minority that you can think of has a right, is a group with rights that trumps the rights of larger groups or something. And that's when we get into this welfare statist group warfare that you have in every country today, basically.
It's interesting you say that. I've never heard anyone speak about it on those terms before. I'm in talking to people on this podcast, I'm always trying to distill down a philosophy to its to its most basic essence. And often I come back to the fact that there's only two types of people. There's individuals and collectivists.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be, I mean, I can, I've gone that way and that way on that notion, but often I realize, I decide, yeah, okay, this is the answer. This is how you categorize the two different things. So I'm with you on that one. I'm not sure that is the absolute essence of the problem, but.
No, we can go deeper because you can go deeper.
Let me just say one other thing first. But so I would just so that I know I understand you well. You're saying basically, rather than wondering about left and right, we need to decide between statism and non-statism. This is the decision to be made.
Yeah. So the non-statism, the name for that is capitalism, and not just capitalism as an economic system. I mean, that's how most people think about capitalism. But we're talking about it as a socioeconomic or social system, the only system that consistently protects and respects individual rights. And that's the moral connection, if you like.
Okay, so let's go into that then, because under this capitalism, what position do power authorities have, if any? Many people would say you need someone to protect private property, but property rights, for example, within that system.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So who takes on that role?
Well, so there is capitalism. I'm a champion of government. People often say, "Well, you're a capitalist," because they equate it with, we're often called libertarians, right? That's something, but. And libertarianism is kind of a diffuse term, just like conservatism. You can group a lot of stuff under that umbrella. But under capitalism, I mean, government is required, but it's a very, 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 very limited government. And so it's the three fundamental branches of government. It's the military to protect us against foreign aggression. It's law enforcement to protect us domestically against the same aggression. And then you have a court system that is metering out justice and so on and so forth. And those are the three branches. Now, where do you draw the line? What does that mean? Those are obviously details that need to be worked out, right? I tend to err on the side of caution. I think that, for instance, there are people who are in the capitalism camp who say that, yeah, there would be a minimum of taxes or something to fund these things. I happen to think that we would easily fund these functions voluntarily in the capitalist society, because it would be a society of such wealth and such economic growth that the share of funds that would be needed to manage those three branches of government would be minimal, and people would be happy to sponsor a military base or a warship or whatever it is that we need to defend ourselves, a drone these days probably, and because there would be so much philanthropic money going around, people who make a lot of money, we're thinking that Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and these guys, they have all this money. Yeah, but there would be a lot more of them in a capitalist society, and they would provide products and services that would lift all boats. And yeah, Jeff Bezos has a huge yacht, right? And he has probably multiple homes. But at some point, there is a diminishing rate of return on all of those, on the stuff, if you like. And what do they do? Well, you look back from the beginning of Industrial Revolution, people with more money that they can spend, what they do, they look for other values in life. And that often takes philanthropic, or they pursue philanthropic endeavors.
So in that system, mm-hmm, of voluntary taxation, mm-hmm, as an individual, not a Jeff Bezos individual, someone, just a normal person, would I have the option to not pay any tax?
Yeah, yeah, you would.
It would be purely, yeah, voluntary.
Uh-huh, purely voluntary. But I think, we're also, there is such a thing in humans called benevolence, right? And we do appreciate, we have a hierarchy of values, if you like. We put ourselves first, hopefully, and then it's our family, our friends, and things like that, our work, and things like that. But on some level in that ladder, in that hierarchy, we look around us and say, wow, that person needs a helping hand, and not as a sacrifice, but it just, we're all humans. We're in this thing called life together on some level, right? And you can see it when we have disasters happening. People, especially in this country, people are helping out. They're sending money. They're going there to help out and things like that. And that's an expression of benevolence. And I think the more freedom you have, the less collectivism, the more that benevolence comes out. Because consciously or not, when people feel that their rights are trampled on by some group or another, and they have to pay all these taxes and things like that, you know, your benevolence takes a hit, right? You say, you know, why should I care on some level? And in a free society where we're all living, trading voluntarily with one another, benevolence thrives. And whatever is not, whomever, I should say, is not doing okay in a society like that, and we're talking about a very small sliver of people, there will be a lot of philanthropic pursuits to help them out, to get out of the hole that they dug for themselves or for no fault of their own or something like that.
Something I just picked up on, and I think this is going back to our discussion about Europe versus America and what they don't understand about each other. And I think you just touched on one of those things when you said, in your hierarchy of needs, you said, hopefully you put
hierarchy of values.
Of values, sorry. Yeah. Hopefully you put yourself first, you said. Mm-hmm. And already I know that that would, that the European mind cannot comprehend that. The Ayn Randian mind knows that implicitly, implicitly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, is that just years and years of collectivist indoctrination that's made your average European think of that as a selfish act?
That's part of it, but it goes deeper than that. And I mentioned earlier, we can go deeper.
Let's go deeper.
Let's go deeper. Yeah. So, I mean, this is something that has been with humankind from the African savannah, basically. You know, back then, collectivism was kind of understandable because the life outside the tribe was instant death, basically. So kind of the group provided the protection. But then, you know, and that then later on kind of carried over when we started to build civilizations and such, and then we got kings and emperors providing the protection. And it's only in the last few hundred years, Enlightenment and post that time, that we have realized that, you know what, it doesn't have to be that way. There is a better way. And it required society to, I think, ascend to a certain level before we even could realize that. But those tribal instincts are obviously still with us. And that's why when you come and talking about rational self-interest, which when we're talking about individualism and individual rights, it has a deeper moral foundation in rational self-interest and the fact that the ultimate purpose of my life, of your life, is me and you, okay? And that goes back to human nature, because we have to think, we have to act in order to survive. And that's how Ayn Rand kind of started to build up her philosophy from the bottom and making it inductively tied to reality. And obviously, and this goes for everybody along the political spectrum, it's a really hard thing to swallow, right? And especially today, you know, it's very interesting to see among conservatives, especially, a lot of them instinctually kind of are in this country, I should say, are very patriotic. They love America. They love the founding principles, revere the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. And then you start to talk about what the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness mean. Those are very selfish goals. And at the same time, many, if not most, conservatives are brought up in a Judeo-Christian tradition, right? And that's one of the things, talking about the differences between Europe and the US, and one of the few things that really surprised me coming here in the first place was how religious and how church-going Americans are. And they subscribe to a morality that is based in Judeo-Christian tradition, you know, with Jesus Christ sacrificing his life on the cross so that we may be for our sins may be forgiven. I mean, that's the base for most people. So when that comes in conflict with the founding principles of America, with your rights, your personal rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And most of them haven't been able to resolve that. And that also, the fact that they hold on to this morality of that sacrifice is good, is undermining their effectiveness in promoting those foundational principles of the country. And what we see on the left is that they don't have that conflict to the same extent. Because whether they are religious or not, you know, they're collectivists. Some group or another has the rights over the. So they're more consistent in their thinking. And that, I think, explains a lot why we're slowly drifting in that direction. And whenever we get a conservative government, yeah, we may get a pause at best. But oftentimes they implement similar programs to the left because that morality, that sacrifice is good, is so hard to think outside of that box. So that is our biggest challenge, I think, in promoting capitalism, individualism, limited government, is that we have to make them comfortable with fighting for that for morally, while still living with the contradiction of having a different moral philosophy, which is really hard, but people are able to do it.
You've just made me think of something actually, and I'd be interested to hear what your opinion on this is. That the way we bring up children in Europe is very much when they're young, it's chair. Nothing should be your own, mm-hmm. you know, et cetera, et cetera. Right. I've got three young children. I've noticed that, yeah, I've kind of been pushing that idea, right? What would Ayn Rand say would be the best way to bring up your children? Well, what would you do via Ayn Rand?
Yeah, I would try to, you know, I wouldn't preach these principles, obviously, to a little child, but I would kind of probably model that behavior. So for instance, if you, Tim, 3 years old, are in the sandbox with your favorite toy, and here comes John and wants to take your toy, you know, this is your favorite toy, the things you value the most in the world right now. And when I come as a parent there, I mean, many parents today, they would come into the sandbox and try to mediate and say, hey, Tim, share your toy with John. And what an affront that is. What an assault it is on you. So as a parent, I will come in and say, hey, John, this is Tim's toy, and Tim wants to play with that now. That's his. He makes the decision. 6 months later, Tim may be perfectly fine because he got tired of the toy and have let John play with it. But it's Tim's decision. It's his toy. You know? And I think you can model that kind of behavior throughout.
What's also interesting about that situation, though, is that you're promoting statism in a way in that by coming in and intervening.
No, I'm promoting limited government.
Oh, okay. There are many paradoxes, though. I see. Okay, let's go. Is there another deeper level to this collectivism versus individualism?
I think the core, I mean, it goes all the way back to metaphysics and epistemology and the fact that as human beings, as I said, the human mind, you know, is our basic tool of survival. We don't have an instinct like animals do. We don't have an automatic system feeding us by sucking nutrition out of the ground or the sun like plants do. We have our mind, and that's how we survive. And in order for that to be respected, you know, we have to be free to think and act, as I mentioned earlier. And that's really the foundation of a morality of rational self-interest.
Is it a personality type? The collectivist and the individualist. Like, what is it that makes someone prefer individualism over collectivism? Because I think when I look around the world, and I don't necessarily think there's a conspiracy here. I think individualists are the minority, right? Would you say, or would you say it's a 50-50 thing?
I think a lot of people are conflicted. I mean, deep down inside, they're individualists. They want what's good for them. They want what's good for their families. You know, they have that hierarchy of values. But then the collectivist, the philosophy or faith or whatever it is, comes in and kind of muddles things up. And so most people, I think, today are very conflicted. They carry around a lot of unearned guilt because this self-interest that they actually have, because they're human in pursuing their life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, conflicts with what they're taught in school or in the church or something like that. And you know, so you have that conflict, which creates a lot of unearned guilt.
So is the objective to just make peace with that contradiction, or is it to do away with the collectivist side? I mean, take religion, for example. Mm-hmm. As you can see, many people in the US are incredibly religious. And it seems like a good thing to me. It seems like where I live, religion is almost non-existent. But where it exists, it's just a community, a place for the community to meet in a way.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are social aspects of it that are obviously, I mean, there's a lot of value in the social group that you meet, and shared values. As a champion of capitalism, my primary purpose is not to convert people. You know, that won't work. Maybe it will happen over the next couple of hundred years. Who knows? But the important part is, I think, to give people the moral courage to embrace the Declaration of Independence, those rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and not feeling guilty for doing that. And that, I think, can provide them with the courage to stand up to collectivism and hopefully become champions of capitalism, even though they may not fully buy into the moral foundation of it. I think you can be a champion of individual rights, morally and politically, while still subscribing to a religious morality. You just have to be aware of the fact that it's a chink in your armor, right? That your opposition will exploit ruthlessly. So you have to be prepared to say, for instance, if we're talking about Social Security, that you confidently can say that Social Security is immoral because it takes from some and gives to others. Right now in this country, it takes from the young and gives to the old because there is no trust fund with money for the ones who are currently tapping into it, and say that's morally wrong, okay? And from there, be able to say that, yes, we agree that we have to solve this problem, but let's do it without having the government being involved. I think you can still be a champion of limited government while still be religious. Well, I'm convinced that you can be that. But you just have to be aware of the fact that you have some weak spots because of the morality you subscribe to and the fact that your opposition will ruthlessly exploit that.
What about squaring up individuality and religion then? I mean, many religious doctrines would would say that sacrifice to the group would be a good idea? Would it sacrifice to mankind kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that would seem a strange... Ayn wouldn't agree to that, would she?
No, but I don't think most people agree with that either. They don't take it to that extreme.
Is that right? So
yeah.
For you, being being religious and being an individualist are happy bedfellows.
Not happy. They are probably somewhat uncomfortable bedfellows. But I think a lot of people probably can live with that.
It's just, okay, so you live with it and you accept the idiosyncrasies of it.
But, frankly, you probably have to ask them, because I'm speculating here.
Me too. I've never thought about it before, actually. I mean, when I think of collectivism, I've always thought of it, obviously, in terms of governments and ideologies that governments that base themselves around. But, you know, obviously, there's a... I mean, it's...
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, it's a good clarification, I think. So I use the term statism for the political expression, you know, when we talk about what kind of government you have. But collectivism goes a bit deeper, because it's this groupism, and a collective doesn't necessarily have to be a political collective. It can be, even in a society without government, probably even more so in a society without government, you would have groups that were fighting each other, and so it doesn't necessarily have collectivism in that sense. Is a broader concept, if you will.
Well, we're also collectivist at home, normally in within our family.
Mm-hmm.
Is that too small to be called a collective?
No, the family can definitely be a collective. I think it's one of the collectives that that conservatives champion, right?
Hmm.
Family comes first.
Yes.
You know, well, no, the individual comes first. Hopefully you have a happy family life, and that is an important part of important value in your life. But if push would comes to shove, and, you know, something happens, you're abused or whatever, you come first.
Hmm.
Family doesn't come first.
So collectivism is a function of scale, then, how it works. The bigger the collective gets, the more destructive collectivism is, I would say. Is that right?
As a general rule, perhaps. But, I mean, we have probably historical examples of minorities inflicting a lot of damage. So if you take communist China, I mean, it was a fairly small clique that started it all. And it doesn't have to start as a mass movement, I think. But if the snowball gets rolling, then of course it...
Going back to your moral spectrum, and your book has actually got the words right and wrong in the title.
Mm-hmm.
So is collectivism wrong?
Yes.
It's wrong.
Morally wrong.
Out and out wrong. That's interesting.
Out wrong, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a strong stance to say. Mm-hmm. So there's no nuance to that.
Nope. Not to collectivism, no.
I mean, even at the family level, say you're in, like, Maya, five of us in a family.
Yeah.
I pretty much run it as like a communist way.
So
I run the family.
I see what you mean. So I mean, the family, you have the issue of bringing up underage children, right? So yeah, but at some level they have individual rights. You can't do whatever you want to them, right? But you have quite a bit of leeway in how to bring up your children. You should probably have a lot more leeway, you know, because I don't know how, if you have to, you don't call it public schools. Public schools are private in Britain, right? Yeah,
yes.
It's very confusing.
Just normal school
or
public school. Public school is paid for school. It's like, you know, fee paying.
Right, right.
Just what you would call high school or normal school.
Okay, yeah. That's probably part of why we separated once.
Yeah, public school is different in the States, isn't it?
Exactly. Anyhow, speaking of the United States, you know, the fact that your family is forced to pay here property taxes, and property taxes is how we mostly fund public schools. Government schools is a better term for it here in the United States. And so that's a violation of your rights as a parent too, because you, whether you like those schools or not, your money is going towards funding them. And then there's regulation, and there is state funding, and there's federal funding. And it's a big debate going on in this country right now, or has been going on for the last 20 years. And there are your individual rights as a provider of your family to bring up your children as you see fit within certain bounds of their individual rights. And this is an area, you know, where there are gray zones, and it becomes, it's important, but it's more of a, to some extent, it's a legalistic detail, what you can do, how old should they be before, you know, you're considered independent and so on and so forth. And
I mean, from a purely anecdotal standpoint, mm-hmm. what I've noticed, having had children and my other friends, is if you create strong rules and then over time let them go, you have very well-adjusted kids when they become older. But it's important to give them those strong rules at the beginning. And, that's another sort of European feature is happening more and more, is people are allowing their children to be very free from a very young age. And that's not the way we bring our children up. We created a very strong boundary within which they're uh-huh. completely free.
Sure.
So they, and then as, yeah. and my kids already know, at 16 years old, there'll be some, the boundary will change. And we've all agreed on that. And at 18 years old, it'll probably disappear completely until you're back with
it. It could be that one of your kids, 18, not so much, let's add another year. And one, well, you're 17, you seem to get this. So, you know, so we're talking about these fixed ages, but they are determined by society. And I think it's more individual than that, actually.
It is. But I suppose the problem with not sticking to those ages is what they will notice is there are other friends mm-hmm. getting freedoms when they're right. not. And, mm-hmm. you know, sure. I mean, I have a very close relationship with both my children. In fact, funnily enough, just before we were speaking, one of my eldest daughter's 12, and she phoned me. They're skiing in France at the moment.
Nice.
That she phoned me in a knife shop saying, Holly, her sister, wants to buy a knife. Can she? What do you think about that? They already have knives. We live in a very rural part of England, so we're always playing with knives and having fires outside and this kind of stuff. But she still, I was quite touched.
Yeah,
she phoned me to say, Dad, look, Holly wants to buy another knife. What do you think about that? But mainly she was asking me because it had a lockable blade and they're actually illegal in the UK.
Oh.
And she said, but isn't it illegal? And I said, well, yes and no. It's not at our home, but yeah, don't carry a locking blade on the tube and then get caught by the police, especially at 12. But no, at home in private property, you're allowed to do whatever you want with regards to things like that. But the point I'm making is she did phone me up.
Yeah, no, she had a sense of responsibility there,
yes,
right? Yeah.
And I really appreciate that about my children. And I think it's come as a result of having these kind of conversations, not laying down the rules so specifically, but saying when the rule gets challenged, which I've taught my children to challenge our rules, then we have a debate about it. And normally my stance is, convince me. Like, if you can convince me, go for it.
Yeah.
I will, you know, and as they get older, they're getting much better at it. And they're getting super good at it, actually, now. You have to be careful now.
Well, you know.
Do you have your own children, by the way?
No, I don't. Oh. But, yeah. You're creating a couple of monsters here, right?
The girls. No, I've got three, actually.
Three, okay.
I'm creating, I think if you were to boil down my philosophy, it would be along the lines of extreme responsibility.
Uh-huh.
That's how my own personal journey has come to realize that responsibility is at the core of a happy life. And it seems a little bit counterintuitive, actually, because many people think taking on responsibility is a burden, and it is in a way. It's a burden in as much as it forces you to act. You don't have so much of a say. If you're in a place, your zone of responsibility extends out from you, And that can be hard sometimes, especially for young children, because they end up being the ones that stand up and make the point, or the other kids don't like that. That you become the pariah very quickly,
and you can be.
I've noticed that amongst amongst my kids.
Yeah.
But then obviously back at home, we talk about these things. We explain why that's important, and actually, it's a long game. I know that by the time they're in their 20s, having lived a life of taking responsibility from a very young age, they'll actually have a superpower over other people. It's like a life hack.
Yeah, but and even, I mean, it's important to relate to other people, obviously. But I mean, isn't taking responsibility for your life the essence of becoming an adult, you know?
Absolutely, 100%. But strangely enough, not a lot of people know that. And I've, especially in Europe, I've watched over the last sort of, I suppose it's been about 8 or 9 years, that responsibility has become the counterculture. It's bizarre. The counterculture used to be born out of the 60s, like, you know, you only live once, screw everything. That was counterculture, if you think about it. And I see now, we're going through a time of, there's a counterculture against that whole culture. And it's the opposite, of course, which is personal responsibility, you know, these kind of attributes. Because I think at the core, you have personal responsibility and you only live once, YOLO. You know, that idea that certain young people have that, look, you know, you should be very selfish and you should just live once.
You should be selfish, right?
Yeah, but in the European sense, I'm talking. Selfish is now a word we have to clarify.
There is the rationally selfish and there is the hedonistic, unrationally selfish.
I'm talking about the hedonistic one. And that is a very common... Hedonism is you know, something I did as a child, for sure. And I can see that now, looking back, the way I lived. Fair, it was super hedonistic. I don't live like that now. It's the opposite. But... you know, I didn't know that. No one pointed the difference out to me. That was the point. No one pointed out to me the merits of responsibility. And I never made the connection between rights and responsibilities. And I think it's a fundamental thing. If you don't understand that, you're easily washed away into the world of these are my rights. I should have this. I should have this. I should have this. And that's the most ugly part of the society we see around us now,
yeah.
I think, personally.
Yeah, so when we talk about, you know, going back to the Declaration of Independence here, that your right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, obviously those rights come with responsibilities, right? So,
So yeah, 100%. I mean, I think the problem we have currently, and I don't know, I'll ask you a question, actually. Do you think we're at a turning point with... the cult of victimization and rights, and as in those kind of group rights? I mean, a lot of people are saying that that's true. We're at a turning point here. What do you think?
I don't know. It's looking like that, but if this is truly a turning point or if it's just a temporary pause again, and with a certain element of rollback, which, I mean, there are some positive signs, but I think it's too early to say. If the current movement is going too far, not just in terms of, and I'm not saying go too far in terms of rolling back DEI and wokeism and things like that, but other aspects of, and I'm talking about the US and the current administration. We saw with the last administration, you know, that they moved too far politically left for their constituency or their past constituency, and they reacted because the American people, for the most part, they're somewhat in the middle of the traditional political scale, left to right, right? On the morally right to wrong, they're in the welfare statist, whether you're conservative or Democrat. But if the political right, if they there is a chance or a risk that they make the same mistake, that they are embracing the far political right ideas too much, in which case they might easily get abandoned by the people who just voted for them. So, and what would happen if it swings back over to this side? Your guess is as good as mine.
Hence your idea that we need to forget the political spectrum and look at the moral spectrum,
which
I have to say, Anders, I think I'm a convert. It's not something I've ever... thank you for articulating it like that. I know all these ideas, I think, and I appreciate all this stuff, but I think that's a very important distinction that you make. And I'll probably use it going forward, to be perfectly honest.
Steal with pride.
So thank you for that. And thanks for taking some time out of this, your day, to come and speak to us. I've really enjoyed it. And yeah, I'm going to take that one forward. Just before we go, what are the pitfalls? What am I going to discover? What are the counter arguments that will come? If any.
I think we've covered them. You know, it will be primarily on the moral level, and you'll get it from the collectivists of all colors, who will continue to insist that there are certain rights of groups that trump those of the individual, and you just have to become comfortable with saying no and advocating why that is not the case.
Collectivists versus individualists, the age-old battle.
The age-old battle indeed.
Well, thank you, Anders. I really appreciate your time, and I've really enjoyed this conversation.
My pleasure.